KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. 18 Democratic attorneys general are suing to block President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship. We'll talk through the Constitution with the Attorney General from New Jersey on Morning Edition from NPR News. Days after a ceasefire in Gaza, violence erupted in the West Bank. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Israel says it launched the military operation to target militants, but could it endanger the ceasefire? Will designating drug cartels as terrorist organizations be effective in curbing the flow of drugs and weapons? Plus, in our Songs That Move You series from Alt Latino, we hear from an L.A. mariachi singer who Kendrick Lamar featured on his latest album. It's Wednesday, January 22nd. Happy birthday to actor Diane Lane. She's 60 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is defending his pardons of about 1,500 people who were convicted or accused of involvement in the attack on the U.S. Capitol.
He was given many years in jail. I thought it was very excessive. And at least the cases that we looked at, these were people that actually love our country, so we thought a pardon would be appropriate.
But police organizations and those who were hurt by the rioters say Trump's decision to pardon criminals is wrong. Tim Hafey was the lead investigator for the House committee that examined the attack.
If you accept the premise that criminal sanctions deter criminal conduct, then it's a short step that the excuse of criminal behavior through these pardons actually encourages criminal behavior.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. One former D.C. police officer who was badly hurt in the riot reportedly says he's now seeking protective orders against the five men who pleaded guilty to violently attacking him on January 6th. President Trump invited three executives to the White House yesterday to announce a new venture known as Stargate. NPR's Chairman Keith reports it's a large investment in artificial intelligence infrastructure.
The CEOs of SoftBank, OpenAI, and Oracle said 10 massive data centers that will be used to run AI technology are already under construction in Texas, and more could be possible. They praised Trump, and he in turn praised the multi-billion-dollar investment.
This monumental undertaking is a resounding declaration of confidence in America's potential under a new president. Let me be a new president. I didn't say it. They did.
Trump has a history of inviting executives to make splashy announcements like this one at the White House, though they haven't always lived up to the hype. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
Mexico has launched a new app for Mexican nationals who are facing deportation or detention in the U.S. Arizona Public Media's Paola Rodriguez reports it explains their legal rights and steps to take in emergencies.
The Consul app also contains a button for users to alert their emergency contacts and officials at the nearest consulate if they're facing detention. Rafael Marcelo Durazo heads the Mexican consulate in Tucson, Arizona, and says the app comes at a time when calls from Mexican nationals are flooding their call center.
The app is making easier the access to communicate with the consulates anytime, but particularly now that so many people are concerned about what is going to mean all the migratory changes that the new administration has announced.
On Monday alone, the consulate received over 1,500 calls about what to do amid mass deportation concerns. For NPR News, I'm Paola Rodriguez in Tucson.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 50 points. The NASDAQ is up nearly 250 points. You're listening to NPR. Winter storm warnings have now been lifted for the southeast U.S. Snow, ice, and freezing rain fell on the region this week. New Orleans was surprised by at least 8 inches of snow. At one point, the Louisiana Gulf Coast was under blizzard warning. The world's wealthiest people are getting even wealthier, according to the anti-poverty group Oxfam International. No one is a trillionaire yet, but NPR's Maria Aspen reports the group predicts that five trillionaires will exist within the next decade.
Billionaire wealth and power is growing faster than ever. And Oxfam is raising the alarm about what this income inequality could mean for our society. Billionaires saw their wealth grow three times faster in 2024 than the year before. Meanwhile, the number of people living in poverty has barely changed since 1990. Oxfam published this report at a time when billionaire power over U.S. politics is increasingly visible. Several tech CEOs and other billionaires attended the inauguration of President Donald Trump, who has assembled the wealthiest U.S. administration in history. Trump is also being advised by the world's wealthiest person, Elon Musk. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
Streaming provider Netflix says it's going to raise its monthly prices for customers. People who take the service with commercials will see their subscription go up a dollar to nearly $8 a month. People who get the ad-free standard version of Netflix will pay nearly $2.50 more at nearly $18 a month. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Coming up, Israel begins a new military offensive in the West Bank. We begin with the wording of the United States Constitution. The 14th Amendment says people born in the U.S. are citizens of the United States. President Trump issued an executive action asserting that some people born in the U.S. are not.
We're the only country in the world that does this with birthright, as you know. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, we'll see. We have very good grounds.
Courts will decide how the law matches up with his opinion because law enforcement officials in 18 states, plus the cities of San Francisco and Washington, D.C., have sued. One of them is New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Plotkin, and he's on the line. Attorney General, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I want to go to the Constitution here. The administration's case revolves around the first sentence of the 14th Amendment. There's a bunch in there, but it begins, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. What does that mean to you in the case of someone who's born in the U.S. and one or both of their parents are here illegally, which is what we're talking about?
Well, Steve, birthright citizenship has been part of the fabric of this nation for centuries, and it was put in the Constitution 157 years ago, as you note, in the wake of the Civil War, when the people of this nation said we were no longer going to let the political whims determine whether or not someone born on United States soil is an American citizen. And it's been upheld by the Supreme Court multiple times. This is, until Monday night, not something that was ever contested by a president who signed an order that was extraordinary, unprecedented, and upended the rule of law.
Well, let's go through the two key phrases in that sentence that I read. The first part, all persons born. I can't believe I need to ask this, but I'm going to ask this. Does all persons born in the United States mean all persons born in the United States?
Of course it does. Okay. And courts have said so for centuries.
Okay, but then the other part is the part the administration is focusing on. All persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. It is said that that phrase gives some wiggle room. You could redefine who is subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and say someone born in the United States to a person who's here without legal status is not subject to the jurisdiction. What do you make of that part of the argument?
I think the administration is twisting itself in knots to try to find a political way of making an argument. There's no good legal argument that people born here are not subject to our jurisdiction. And frankly, for an administration that is taking such a hard line on undocumented immigration and removing those individuals, saying they do not have jurisdiction over those people is directly in contradiction to what they are saying in other aspects of their immigration policy. So again, this has not been a controversial legal position for centuries. And for 157 years, the plain text of the Constitution has provided this right. And all we are saying is that while presidents are powerful, they are not kings, and they cannot rewrite the Constitution with the stroke of a pen.
Of course, many of the Supreme Court justices describe themselves as originalists. They'll want to go back to the original public meaning, or they may even go into the intent in some cases. Well, like, why is that language in there? So tell me, do you understand why that phrase is in there, subject to the jurisdiction thereof?
Well, I think you have to remember the reason why birthright citizenship is in the 14th Amendment. Again, 157 years ago, in the wake of this nation's civil war.
Yeah, I get that, but the time is short. I just want to know, why is that phrase in there, subject to the jurisdiction thereof? It does seem to limit the power in some way.
But again, Steve, courts have already reviewed this and said very clearly that people born here, going back to the 1890s, the Supreme Court has reviewed this and said people born here are subject to birthright citizenship.
Is this an exception for like diplomats, like the children of diplomats who aren't subject to the jurisdiction of the United States? Is that what this is about?
There is potentially that, but the order is not focused, as you know, on diplomats. The order is much more broadly targeted on people born here to non-citizen parents, which again has been something we have provided American citizenship for centuries.
Just got about 15 seconds left. Are you prepared to file a lot of lawsuits against this administration?
We're prepared to stand up for the rule of law, and that's what we're doing here, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Matthew Plantkin is the Attorney General of the state of New Jersey. Attorney General, thanks for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it. We'll keep following this case as it goes forward.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Okay, the ceasefire in Gaza is holding in a fourth day.
But Israel has announced a new military operation, this time in the occupied West Bank. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, says the military is using key lessons learned from the war in Gaza.
We're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, who was just there. Hey there, Kat.
Hey.
Okay, so we're told this military operation focuses on the Jenin refugee camp, which is a phrase we use from time to time in this coverage. But what do we mean when we say refugee camp?
Yeah, so this is a place where Palestinians have lived for many generations. It's not tents like you might think of when you hear refugee camp. It's basically a city where lots of Palestinian families and kids live with houses and schools. You know, Jenin has also long been a militant stronghold. Attacks that have killed Israelis have been launched from there. Right now, it's hard to get information on what's happening on the ground there because it's essentially become a closed military zone in the past few days. We do know that an Israeli airstrike there killed at least 10 Palestinians and wounded many more, according to Palestinian health officials. Israel says this is a counterterrorism operation aimed at strengthening security in the West Bank. Palestinian forces have also clashed with these fighters. And there also have been Israeli military operations there in the past. I went into the Jenin refugee camp after the last major one in the fall, and that operation lasted weeks and was very, very destructive.
I feel we need to dwell always on the map here when we say West Bank. So there's Gaza, which is a separate area which was the center of the war between Israel and Hamas, where there's now a ceasefire. The West Bank is a separate area, much bigger in size. Millions of Palestinians live there. A lot of Israeli settlers have also moved in with the sanction of the Israeli government. And we have this bit of news that President Trump, after his inauguration, has said he will end sanctions on Israeli settlers in the West Bank. What does that mean?
Yeah, so President Biden put those sanctions in place to try to de-escalate violent Israeli settler attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. Those attacks have increased dramatically since the war in Gaza began. There have been some attacks on Israeli settlers, too. Even just this weekend, there were Israeli settler attacks on Palestinian villages. They burnt cars and other property. You know, settler groups said that this was timed to coincide with the release of Palestinian detainees and prisoners in accordance with the Gaza ceasefire deal. President Trump now canceling those sanctions on Israeli settlers, you know, certainly coming after what happened this weekend, really doesn't discourage that kind of violence.
How is all this affecting life in the West Bank?
It's made life throughout the West Bank difficult, even in the areas not directly affected. The West Bank consists of a series of checkpoints and designated roads for Palestinians, and most of those have been closed by the Israeli military, making travel throughout the area really hard. And on top of that, many Palestinians in the West Bank worry that Israelis' military focus is shifting over to them now that there's a ceasefire in Gaza. I talked to 53-year-old Walid Amra in Ramallah about this the day the ceasefire in Gaza went into effect. He told me, of course the war is coming here. The Israeli government wants to prove something to their people, and the West Bank will become the place where they can prove it, he said.
And of course, there's a new presidential administration, as we mentioned. How do they view the West Bank?
Yeah, I mean, several of President Trump's appointees, you know, are very pro-Israel. Mike Huckabee, who will be the next U.S. ambassador in Jerusalem, has visited Israel several times and argued that the West Bank belongs to Israel. Elise Stefanik, who is set to be the next U.N. ambassador, said in her confirmation hearing yesterday that Israel has a right to the West Bank as well. So if Israel does make moves to annex the West Bank, it seems likely the U.S. administration will give them the green light to do so.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A major winter storm hit parts of the U.S. that don't often see snow, sleet, and freezing rain. Wind chills are in the single digits from Texas into Florida, and officials in the region are telling people to stay off the roads, and in some places, they're ordering curfews. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO reports from New Orleans, where 10 inches of snow set a record.
I'm standing on the street in my neighborhood in New Orleans, and the cars all have a layer of snow over them. Palm trees are frosted over. It's just an incredible sight to see this type of weather in such a tropical place.
Be ready to stay essentially housebound Wednesday and even into Thursday.
That's Jay Grimes. He's the Louisiana State climatologist. He says the Gulf states haven't seen this bad of a winter storm since the 1960s, and many homes aren't built for it.
Widespread power outages as well as impacts to frozen pipes are going to be an issue across the state.
Dangerous roads are also a big concern, as many cities don't have plows or enough salt trucks to keep up. There have been a lot of car and truck accidents. Transportation officials have shut down airports from Texas to Georgia and several major interstates due to low visibility and ice. Here's Georgia Governor Brian Kemp.
If that precipitation hits the ground, melts, and then refreezes, all of a sudden you're going to have a lot of chaos out there on the roadways.
As the storm moves east, bone-chilling weather is expected to hang around through at least Thursday. In New Orleans and many towns in the region, most government services and businesses are shut down, and residents are stuck at home. Meanwhile, 6-year-old Clark Nelson is making the most of his first ever snow day. His parents, Nell and John, are coming up with activities on the fly.
Yeah. We got the inner tube from, like, the beach, and we've been dragging him up and down the street. Yeah.
Yeah, we weren't really prepared with the, you don't have, like, any sleds or anything like that at all. We just had to improvise, you know?
What has it been like tubing around?
Like fun.
For the Nelsons and many families in the Deep South, this snowstorm will be a memory for a long time to come. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
the next fresh air, Pamela Anderson. She became a pop culture phenomenon in the late 80s, in part because of her role on the series Baywatch. But there's much more to her than that. She received Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild Award nominations for her role in the new film, The Last Showgirl. A documentary about her was nominated for an Emmy. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Next, we hear a story about the spirit of Los Angeles. It's part of our series called Songs That Move You from NPR's radio show and podcast, Alt Latino, hosted by Ana Maria Sayer and Felix Contreras.
As Los Angeles grapples with the recent wildfires, I've been finding solace in the sound that, to me, is quintessential LA, mariachi. Growing up in Southern California, it was the soundtrack to life at home or family parties, until a few months ago when it made its way onto the record of one of the most famous rappers in the world. Okay, Felix, get this. It's game one of the 2024 World Series, Yankees versus Dodgers. Mexican baseball legend Fernando Valenzuela had just died. And so to open the game, he's being honored by a sound that many Angelenos mourn to, crying mariachi voices. That voice, that's Valenzuela's friend, who until then was little-known singer Deira Barrera. As luck would have it, or maybe you could say that it's just so LA, Kendrick Lamar happens to be in the crowd, soaking up that morning grito. The LA Dodgers would go on to win the World Series, and Kendrick Lamar was so moved by Barrera's voice that he invited her to be the first voice heard on his latest album, GNX.
Yesterday somebody whacked out my mural. That energy will make you move to Europe.
And the rest, as they say, is history. And for this week's Songs That Move You, we ask Barrera to tell us about a song that moves her.
La canción que siempre me conmueve se llama A Mi Manera. Esta canción es como un pasaje de la vida de cada persona.
Barrera says the song My Way, or A Mi Manera, done by the late mariachi superstar Vicente Fernandez, is about the passing of time for each of us.
Ahora sé.
Es hablando de cómo viviste tu vida a tu manera.
The song talks about living life your way. So many things happen, things we let go of that we didn't understand. At the end, you did what you wanted. Your way. But for her, it's not just a message in a song. It's about who in her life lived on her own terms.
Crecí viendo a mi mamá cantar y ella me enseñó mis primeros pasos en la guitarra.
She says she grew up watching her mom sing, and it was her who taught Barrera her first chords on the guitar before she continued to study music, vocals, and performance. Like for me, mariachi was the sound of family for Barrera.
Me encantaba nomás verla tocando su guitarra, cantando.
She told us she loved just watching her mom play and sing with her guitar. And instead of playing with the other kids, she watched the adults sing and would say, I want to sing, I want to sing.
Ahora sé que fui feliz, que si lloré también amé, puedo seguir hasta el final.
And she became a singer like her mother. Today, life looks different for Barrera and her mom.
Mi mami, que pues desgraciadamente tiene demencia y ella vivió su vida muy a su manera.
Now, Barrera's mother is living with dementia, but her memory lives immortalized in the emotional delivery of the song she sang, and in Barrera's voice, too.
You know, Ana, the song can seem like a curious choice for a mariachi singer, but if we trace the musical breadcrumbs left in its wake, it makes total sense. The song is mostly associated with Frank Sinatra. He released it in March of 1969.
And I stood tall, and did it my way.
And it was his song until the flamenco group the Gypsy Kings did a popular Spanish language remake in 1987. Which expanded the message of self-determination and perseverance to a worldwide Spanish-speaking audience. And a Spanish cover of a popular English language song is not rare. In fact, it reflects the bilingual and bicultural way of life for us Latinos in this country. And while the Gypsy Kings had a hit with their flamenco-tinged interpretation, what paved the way for that was the mariachi take on it, released a few years before.
Barrera's favorite version will always be the king of mariachis. And as Barrera's mom's memory slips away, she told us it gives her peace, knowing that through it all, her mother, a singer from Sonora, Mexico, an immigrant to Los Angeles, she lived her life her way.
Es algo que me llega mucho a mi corazón, la canción.
The song is something really close to her heart, she said. A lesson to hold on to from LA to the world.
Porque sabrás que un hombre al fin conocerá.
Ana Maria Sayer and Felix Contreras, the hosts of Alt Latino. It's a podcast and radio show that takes a weekly look at Latin music and culture. You can find it online, on the NPR app, and on your radio. And they want to hear about a song that moves you. Write to them at alt.latino@npr.org. This is NPR News.
Evacuation orders have been lifted in parts of LA as the city continues to battle wildfires. But for those with houses still standing, it's unclear if returning home is safe.
Part of our concern is making sure what we're coming back to is a place that's not just whole, but safe and stable for our family. Like, not every toxin is obvious.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson says he stands with President Donald Trump on the January 6th pardons.
It was a terrible time and a terrible chapter in America's history. The president's made his decision. I don't second guess those. And yes, you know, it's kind of my ethos, my worldview. We believe in redemption. We believe in second chances.
A newly sworn-in Trump followed through on his pledge to grant clemency to rioters who were charged with crimes in the 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The attack resulted in several deaths and many more injuries. The National Association of Police Organizations said, quote, those who commit violent assaults on law enforcement officers should not benefit from a pardon. The full U.S. Senate has yet to decide if it will confirm Pete Hegseth for defense secretary. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports Hegseth's former sister-in-law has submitted an affidavit accusing the former Fox News host of threatening behavior.
Danielle Hegseth says, in her personal opinion, Pete Hegseth is, quote, unfit for the job. She says her former sister-in-law, Samantha, Hegseth's second wife, who he divorced, feared for her personal safety during their marriage. She often hid in a closet. She said Samantha had a plan about texting her a safe word or code word that meant she wanted someone to fly to Minnesota to help her. Danielle Hegseth also said she personally witnessed Hegseth intoxicated, yelling in her face.
NPR's Deirdre Walsh reporting. From Washington, this is NPR News. Millions of people are contending with the aftermath of what's being described as once-in-a-generation snowfall in the South. Several deaths are linked to Tuesday's winter storm. Florida, nicknamed the Sunshine State, recorded as much as 8 inches of snow in some areas, according to local media. Pensacola broke a more than century-old record with 5 inches of snow. States of emergency were declared from Florida to Louisiana. Prince Harry and a senior British lawmaker have settled a years-long litigation with Rupert Murdoch's British tabloids. NPR's David Folkenflik reports from London. Murdoch's company offered a sizable payment and a full apology for illegal invasions of privacy stretching back decades.
With the settlement, Murdoch avoids a public trial at which Prince Harry and former Member of Parliament Tom Watson's lawyers would have laid out evidence of copious lawbreaking by the tabloids and by the executives that oversaw them. The apology was the first time the Murdoch company had acknowledged wrongdoing at the Daily Sun tabloid. The papers also apologized for putting Watson under surveillance while he was investigating the Murdoch-owned tabloids in Parliament. Outside the courthouse, Watson called for Scotland Yard to review the evidence that senior Murdoch executives covered up criminal acts by the tabloids, among them the company's British CEO, as well as the current publisher of the Washington Post, William Lewis. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
U.S. stocks trading higher. The Dow is up 117 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. One of the many executive orders Trump signed on Inauguration Day called on the State Department to designate Mexico's drug cartels and two Latin American gangs as foreign terrorist organizations. Now, a decision like this typically takes months, but Trump gave the State Department 14 days to make a recommendation. The question now is, how would classifying cartels as terrorists change the way the U.S. fights drug trafficking and what it means for the sovereignty of other nations? Mike Vigil spent 3 decades with the Drug Enforcement Administration, including as its chief of international operations in the early 2000s, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you for being here. I mean, I think I just want to start with what this decision would actually do when it comes to dealing with the flow of drugs and violence.
It really would not do anything because the actions that would be undertaken under a terrorist designation are already being done. Number one, it allows the U.S. government to seize bank accounts and properties belonging to these designated groups in the United States, not abroad, just in the United States. Secondly, it would sanction American citizens if they have any ties to businesses belonging to these designated groups. And then thirdly, tries to prevent them from coming into the United States. That's being done and has been done for decades. And this is nothing more than political theater. But here's the problem, that by designating these groups, it's going to alienate Mexico, and we need to work very closely with Mexico in order to attack some of the biggest drug trafficking networks that exist in the world.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, Mexico has expressed concern around sovereignty, especially the possibility of U.S. military action. I mean, we've seen the U.S. go after designated terrorist organizations in other places without the permission of the nation state, right? Is that a possibility?
I don't think so, because Mexico is one of our largest trading partners. And by going in and attacking the cartels in Mexico, that would be an act of war. And what we would see are other Latin American countries aligning with Mexico. And then a lot of these countries might go even further and align themselves with China.
But would the designation give political cover to a decision like that? I mean, that is what the U.S. has done in places like Yemen, Syria, Iraq.
No, it would not give coverage to that. You know, there's been attacks in Syria and other areas, but it doesn't have to do with the Terrorist Designation Act. These are actions that have been taken by the U.S. government to try to eliminate Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, if you will.
Houthis, all designated terrorist organizations.
But to attack a country that has been aligned with the United States for decades would be a disaster, a complete disaster.
What happens to businesses and individuals who have no choice but to deal with cartels who control their areas?
This designation would impact on U.S. citizens if they have ties to those businesses, so they would have to basically sever them, even though it might damage their business enterprise. But here's the other thing. About 80% of the weapons that are found in Mexico come from the United States, and the cartels generate a lot of violence and intimidation in Mexico as a result of those weapons. So the key question here is, why are we arming the people that we're supposed to be fighting?
Mike Vigil is a former chief of international operations for the Drug Enforcement Administration. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
This next story takes us to the UK, where Prince Harry has agreed to settle his lawsuit against Rupert Murdoch's British tabloids. This ends a long battle to hold the newspapers accountable for invasions of privacy into his life and also the life of his mother, Princess Diana. The deal was announced just before a trial, which NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik was in London to cover. David, welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
What happened?
So you saw a very dramatic thing where the lawyers for Prince Harry and for a veteran British lawmaker named Tom Watson announced they had reached a settlement that had wrapped up what was supposed to be a six-week trial here.
A six-week trial, substantial damages, I guess, meaning that Rupert Murdoch will pay substantial damages, we imagine. What were the cases about?
Got to imagine it's in the many of millions. So this was an instance in which Prince Harry and Watson were alleging a series of things. In Harry's case, what News Corp in Britain acknowledged was that for essentially 15, 16 years that the Sun tabloid had been engaging in unlawful intrusions into his personal life, getting information. The News of the World, another Sunday tabloid they then closed during the height of the scandal, had, you know, engaged in phone hacking and other unlawful and unwarranted invasions of his privacy. They essentially apologized to him for going into his personal life in deep and unlawful and insensitive ways, and even reached back to his childhood and to apologizing for the treatment of his mother, Princess Diana, who was essentially hounded by the Murdoch tabloids as well as their competitors for most of her adult life. In the case of Tom Watson, they apologized for putting him under surveillance, which, you know, is a rather extraordinary thing because the time period in which they did it was a period in which he was investigating the Murdoch tabloids for this kind of criminality as a senior member of parliament.
Ah, so they were investigating the investigators, so to speak, or spying on the investigator would be a better way to put it.
Yeah, Tom had an incredible moment where he apologized to his ex-wife for the strain it put on their relationship and their family.
Wow. Well, what are some of the implications of this case?
Well, some of them reach into the United States. You know, Will Lewis was a senior executive at News UK, the British newspaper wing, in 2011 as this scandal reached a height. He was accused, along with other executives, of orchestrating a cover-up and essentially destroying evidence, lying to police. They were going to present all this evidence in open court. In a sense, you could imagine Lewis and other executives would breathe a sigh of relief, but this information, according to Tom Watson, is being conveyed to Scotland Yard. And this morning, in a dramatic press conference outside the courthouse, you know, I was there as he basically called on the head of Scotland Yard to engage in a full criminal investigation, which has also been pushed for by a former British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. So we're going to see whether this is really a few bad days of headlines for Will Lewis, for Murdoch, and for some of his executives, or in fact, that there are longer repercussions that emerge.
Okay, so the civil case is over. Criminal investigations, we don't know. NPR's David Falcon Flick in London. Thanks for the update. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
Always a pleasure talking with you right here on NPR News.
Wildfires around Los Angeles continue to subside and people are returning home. We find out how a city recovers from such devastation next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. When an aquarium in Japan closed for renovations, one of its residents, a sunfish, started acting strangely. The staff couldn't figure out why until one employee suggested maybe it's lonely since all the visitors are gone. So the staff created makeshift people by sticking their uniforms to the side of the tank and adding cardboard cutout faces. The next day, the sunfish's disposition turned sunny again. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Baseball's Hall of Fame has three new members this morning, including Seattle Mariners star Ichiro Suzuki, the first Japanese player in the Hall. NPR's Becky Sullivan has his story.
It took only 8 games in the major leagues for Ichiro Suzuki to command the nation's attention.
Ground ball, base hit in the right field.
His Mariners were playing the Oakland A's. Seattle had a slim lead in the 8th inning when the A's came out swinging. With a runner on base, someone slapped a hit to right field, where the Mariners' new outfielder from Japan was waiting to throw the runner out.
Holy smoke, a laser beam strike from Ichiro!
By the time Ichiro came to the States in 2001, he had been a star for years in Japan, where he played for a team in Kobe. He debuted there in 92, at a time when the national mood in Japan was at a low. The bubble economy of the 1980s was bursting, and in 1995, disaster struck in Kobe when a massive earthquake killed thousands. People needed something to feel hopeful about, said Kiyo Terutsui, a sociology professor at Stanford who follows Japanese baseball.
And in that year, remarkably, I mean, it's like a Hollywood movie. His team, based in Kobe, won Japan's championship after the earthquake hit Kobe hard. I mean, everybody in Japan knew him, and he was the superstar in Japan's baseball.
Here in the U.S., though, there was skepticism about Japanese players. Only a few had made it to the major leagues, and they were pitchers who didn't have to field or bat every day. Ichiro was an outfielder, a pretty small guy, too, and there were a lot of doubts about him.
Whether he's too small, he doesn't have the stamina to withstand the rigors of a major league schedule of 162 games. Actually, some experts predicted that he would fail.
When he arrived in Seattle in 2001, the reception was not all good. During his first training camp, he said, people told him to go back to Japan. But things changed fast. That year, Suzuki won Rookie of the Year and American League Most Valuable Player, just the second player in baseball history to do that. At the plate, he was a terrific batter in the small ball way, with singles and stolen bases to spare. He was an all-star 10 times. He had more than 3,000 hits over his major league career. After stints in New York and Miami, Suzuki retired a Mariner in 2019. His last game with the Mariners was in Japan. The crowd at the Tokyo Dome gave him an enormous ovation.
Ichiro Suzuki! For the final time, coming off a major league field.
Suzuki told reporters afterwards his records and achievements didn't feel important anymore by comparison. That moment, he said, made everything else seem so small. Now he's come to the Hall of Fame at a moment when Japanese players are more prominent than ever in Major League Baseball, and the doubts about them are gone for good. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. And this afternoon, All Things Considered, where today we will hear from some of the 18 million Americans who have survived cancer. Life after diagnosis on All Things Considered. Listen on the NPR One app or right here on the radio. This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a glimpse of the road ahead for Los Angeles after its wildfires. You can see that road by calling a community that already traveled it, Paradise, California. Jen Goodland grew up in that town in the state's northern mountains. She later moved out of California, and then, in 2018, she was watching the news as almost her entire hometown burned to the ground.
I felt so helpless in Colorado. Like, how many Target gift cards can I send, right? I came back to visit a few months after the fire, saw the completely devastated community, but all I thought was, I'm home. And what's the best way to help home is move there, right?
You were the Target gift card. You sent yourself.
I sent myself and drug my family along, my four children and my husband, and said, how about we leave our great life and move to a burnt downtown and live in a trailer for 2.5 years?
She volunteered there, helping people to get food and get them sheds for their tools as they rebuilt. And then she took a job as executive director of the Rebuild Paradise Foundation, which finds money to help with rebuilding.
Pre-construction costs like surveys, architect and engineering fees, permit fees. Same with septic. Septic was hit heavily, very expensive. We are a community, the largest community west of the Mississippi, still on septic tanks. So when you have a $14,000 expense, we wanted to ease that burden. And then we also created a master floor plan library where residents can access plans already approved through the town and county. We've had hundreds of permits from it. And then the past year or so, insurance has been a huge, it's really strangled our recovery because no one can get insurance. So we created a new grant program where we provide homeowners with gravel to create 5 feet of defensible space around the perimeter of their home.
Oh, which I guess we should underline this. That makes the home a lot less flammable, just that 5 feet, and I bet that affects their insurance rates. Is that right?
100%.
I appreciate that you're telling me about septic tanks, gravel, fire prevention, because you're telling me that so much of this work is unglamorous, really basic, logistics, simple, simple, simple.
Yeah, it's not sexy at all. We have had one pretty cool project that was a little bit more fun. We actually needed a new elementary school last year, just an explosion of young families and children. So we went to 13 different schools, got every child's handprints on a ceramic tile, had them fired in kilns at our local college, and we created 3 murals of sunset. So it's kind of this reflection of not only our growth and all the kids, but our views now. We know with the loss of trees, we have sunsets. All these handprints had to go through a fire, which made them stronger. And it was really fun to be a part of that.
I'm thinking of how forest fires are part of nature, and one thing they do is clear away the old growth and make room for new growth. Is that effectively what is happening with your town?
Yeah, we get a fresh start, right? So there's this unspoken camaraderie within our community of those who maybe went through it and those who are choosing now to be a part of it.
And many people have now learned this phrase, wildland-urban interface.
Yeah, wooey.
That's where you're living. You're living in the woods. You're living in a place where many people might say, makes no sense to live there at all. Do you think that the new construction has changed things enough that it does make sense to live there?
I do. You know, we had a big fire near us this year. We even had an evacuation warning, and I felt completely safe because we have been prepping for this for 5 years. Some people will wonder, why would you move there? I'm like, well, right now I think it's one of the safest places.
What's your advice for Los Angeles as people there already talk about rebuilding their homes?
My first thought is you really just take it one step at a time. You have to just, you know, eat an elephant one bite at a time. That's how you get it done.
Gravel, septic tanks, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, for us, I can't even tell you how many weeds I've pulled. Instead of looking at my whole yard, I had to look at like, okay, I'll just pull 100 today and then tomorrow. That's how you get through. We actually, a few days before this fire hit, we posted this, and it's so timely. It says, one day you will tell the story of how you overcame, and it will be someone else's survival guide. We never want this on someone else, but like, we are here. We have gone through it, similar but different, and how can we help you now? People came to our side as well, and that's now our job.
Jen Goodland, executive director of the Rebuild Paradise Foundation in California. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
President Trump's inaugural address added to the culture wars by announcing a name change for the highest peak in North America.
We will restore the name of a great president, William McKinley, to Mount McKinley, where it should be and where it belongs.
He issued an executive order for the name change.
So what's the backstory? Our team placed a call to Joan Antonsen with the Alaska Historical Society to hear her view of the mountain. Literally, her view.
I'm in Anchorage, and it's several hundred miles from the mountain. And on a clear day, it stands prominently on the horizon. It's magnificent.
Wow. Antonsen told us the debate over the mountain's name dates back more than a century. In 1917, the area became Mount McKinley National Park, named after a president who'd never been there but had been assassinated some years earlier.
Decades later, in the 1970s, a movement emerged to change the name. Native Alaskan groups used a variety of names for the mountain, and they settled on one.
Denali is a Koyukon word that means the high one or the big one.
Took a while, but the park was eventually renamed Denali National Park, and then during the Obama administration in 2016, the mountain was renamed Denali too.
There may have been some who opposed it, but they didn't call me or send me letters or emails to that effect.
Both of Alaska's U.S. senators are against the move. They say there is only one name worthy of the peak bestowed upon it by Alaska's native people, the name Denali. So how will Antonsen refer to the mountain going forward?
Well, if I'm writing something as a historian, and that's the way it is referred to in something I'm referencing, I'll maybe put a footnote in to note that that's the former name of the mountain known as Denali.
People may call it what they like, but in 30 days, the official name returns to that of one of Trump's favorite presidents, who governed during the Gilded Age of Millionaires, years when the United States added an empire and the government paid for itself through high tariffs. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faudel.